Amen. Good morning.
How is everyone? So good to see you all. For those of you who don't know me, my name's John. Welcome to West City. We're family, which means you can have a level of vulnerability and openness. I want to just tell you how my day started. Why are you laughing already? My day started between 4 and 4:30. I can't exactly remember. It wasn't the first time I'd been awake today. I got up about 4:20 with our beautiful little girl, who's more beautiful now that it's 10 o'clock. And I just thought, I'll just get up, I'll read a book. She was playing, she was really happy, as she always is at 4:30. And so we just hung out for about an hour, I think. Then she had something to eat. And then about 6 o'clock, I thought, oh, it's probably time to put her down to bed, which it was. And she went, she complied. And I got to about 6:30, my boys started to get up. And I was there. I brought them out into the living room and said, you've got to be quiet while you eat your rice bubbles. And they were really good. They were complying again. Compliance. Beautiful. And I thought, I know what I'm going to do. I made a beautiful loaf of sourdough bread yesterday. And so I was like, I'm going to have some bread. I'm going to have some eggs. It's going to be beautiful. And so I made it. And then they left the room, the boys, and they went into the other room and they started getting changed, but they can't get changed without playing a game. And so there's incredible volume. And I thought, should I go and tell them to be quiet? I just finished cooking my breakfast. I finished cooking my breakfast and I like to construct it so it looks beautiful for no reason. You got to have some meaning. And it looked perfect. And then the volume started to increase from there. And then I heard the noise from her room. She was awake. I got to tell you, I've been awake for what, 3 hours already at that point? And so I thought, I'm just going to try and eat my breakfast. So I went into a back room. So I closed 3 doors, I think. I went and sat by myself in a room, and I could still hear it. The volume started to increase from her. The volume started to increase from my boys. And so what I did was I got a towel, and I put one end in this ear, and I wrapped it around my face. This is not a joke. Really tight, and I tucked in at the top. And then I made a mouth hole, and I ate my breakfast in silence. So if you think that you have to have it all together to be here, they let me here. And that's how I started my day. I love the song that we sung, not the last one, I like that too, but the one before that, the one which says, so let go my soul, and trust in him. The waves and wisdom. Like, I think that's really important in moments where things are supposed to make sense. You're supposed to know how things are going to go, but they don't make sense. I think there's an incredible beauty in the language of letting go, letting your soul go. But I think it's much more difficult to do oftentimes than we think it is. To let go of how everything is supposed to work. To let go sometimes of our expectations of what the morning is supposed to be like. Or what life is supposed to be like. And so this morning, we're going to take a bit of a journey into that. And it's going to be a little bit challenging, I think, because we're going to deal with some scriptures that fundamentally we don't often bring to the front of our church communities because they're quite difficult to wrestle with. And so we're going to do that. We're going to take a journey into the depths of despair. But I want you to remember that song. That you trust as you let go of certain things, your trust is in him, and that ultimately we were hopefully going to navigate our way out of that dark place. It's a great way to start. So if you haven't been tracking with us the last few weeks, we're in the middle of a series, and we do a series every year as a community on the Sermon on the Mount, because the Sermon on the Mount is the Jesus's teachings on how to live as part of his kingdom. And so part of the thing we need to do when we talk about the Sermon on the Mount is figure out what does his kingdom look like, and then we can listen to his words and we realize, this is what he's calling us to. And so this year we're looking at the Sermon on the Mount through the Beatitudes, those strange blessings at the beginning of Matthew 5. And we started with blessed are the poor in spirit, and then we moved all the way through. And so today we're at this strange one where Jesus says, Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice or righteousness, for they will be filled. And so just quickly, there's a bit of etymology. We just need to look at the words. There's a word there. A lot of your Bibles will have, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. The word used for righteousness is the same word that's used for justice. It's the same word. What it is trying to capture is a vision of how God wants the world to look, which is ultimately what the Sermon on the Mount is all about. God's saying, this is the world that I have created and I want you to participate in. And this is how you belong and how you participate. The translation in Matthew 5:6 is most likely justice simply because it has reference to hungering and thirsting. You know, the ones who were most desperate for justice to see God's vision of a world where everything was right were those that were hungry and thirsty, those that suffered. And so my screen just went off, which has nothing to do with what I was just about to say. Let me just load it back up again. So we're going to explore for a little bit the idea of what it is to be people of justice and people of righteousness. And the challenge, I think, when we come to language like this, unable to reconnect. I'm not sure. Sorry, what's going to happen? We'll just have to wing it. The challenge, I think, for all of us, I've got a definition. Can you move to the next slide? Because we popped the definition on the bottom there. The back again? Yeah, that's the one. Our definition for this word is going to be the actions and characteristics that represent God's new world. So the whole vision of justice that we're going to carry as we hunger and thirst for justice today is, what does it look like to participate in God's new world? What are the characteristics of God's new world? And the problem when we talk about things like justice or things like righteousness is that we all have very, very different interpretations of what that looks like. And we all think that they're God's, which I don't necessarily think is a problem, but I think it's definitely something we need to be aware of. See, my vision for justice, my vision when I approach the Sermon on the Mount, what I see is God speaking to us about, could actually be fundamentally different to your vision for justice. And in fact, it could be more than different. It could be contrasting. It could be opposite. It could be something wildly different. I can't think of any examples to use without offending someone. But you know what I mean, right? You know what it is to come up against someone who has a faith that is strong, a belief that is true, but has an entirely different way of seeing the world. I actually think one of the beautiful things about this community is that we've found a beautiful way to hold in tension all of those different worldviews. Now, you can't have a community with such vast diversity without occasionally brushing up against each other, but for some reason, we manage to hold it together a lot of the time, and I think that's beautiful. But we need to be aware, I think, that when we talk about justice, when we talk about being people that hunger and thirst for justice, thanks heaps, Jim, we often have very different things in mind. And so the premise this morning, and I'm glad that song was played, is how do we begin to let go of our expectations of what we think the world should look like? Because that's oftentimes what happens when we're navigating this vision of justice, of righteousness. I mean, some people think of sort of works of aid and development. Some people think of things of morality and all that sort of things. And I think everything in here is included. But this morning, we're going to have a look at what it is to let go of our own expectations, maybe of our own preconceptions, and step into something entirely different. And perhaps in letting go, we'll find something of God in the midst of it. But I need to, I have another, I always have disclaimers. I think it's because I'm afraid of getting caught out and I feel like I need to at least let you know where I'm coming from. Every month or so, I have an existential crisis. I think some of you would relate. I think there's just some people in life who are just predisposed to depressive sort of existential angst. I've been helping a friend with an assignment. He's an architecture student, he's my closest friend, and his architecture assignment was on neoliberalism. And for those of you who don't understand neoliberalism, no one does. It's essentially the system, the world which we live in. And the question was, can the economic structure of the world in which we live in the West solve social issues? Which is a weird architecture assignment. And so he was struggling. And I was trying to help him. And then I came up with an example to help him understand why it couldn't. And it plummeted me into this existential crisis for weeks, which I haven't quite worked my way out of yet. So maybe that's what. So good, you got me in the middle of it. But I came up with this example because one of our friends, beautiful friends, have just started an ethical fashion label. And it's really cool, it's really beautiful. And I'm a big advocate for if you're going to buy clothes, buy them ethically. You know, it's good. But the example that I used to try and explain this kind of neoliberal, whatever, this world, was I said that, you know, they've set up this beautiful company, they've got these beautiful clothes, and they're sourcing all their cotton, and so everything's ethical, the ink is ethical, they're providing, like, opportunities for communities that are going to, it's all brilliant. It's like, but, and there's always a but, like, the problem is that a lot of, like, world poverty, a lot of the stuff that's wrong with the world isn't just because we buy cheap clothes, it's because we consume so much. It's because of overconsumption, right? It's not that we have clothes that are sourced wrongly, it's that we have like 50 different t-shirts and we only wear 3 of them. Overconsumption is often the problem. I said, so the problem with their beautiful ethical fashion label is that the only way that's ever going to work is if people consume. Which means that in order for that beautiful, just business to get off the ground, it needs to participate in the same cycle that actually caused the problem that's trying to fix. Which is why I'm in this pit of despair. No, I'm kidding. I'm not. So we kind of hashed that out a little bit. And then he got on with writing his assignment. And I got on with reading a part of the Bible that I only ever turn to when I'm struggling like this. I turn to Ecclesiastes. Which is a terrible, terrible idea. And so we're going to dabble in Ecclesiastes for a little bit. Because I found my soulmate in Solomon, who himself seemed to have these cyclic existential crises where he struggled to make sense of the world. And, you know, I've got to be honest, I think it's healthy to every now and again, you know, maybe not as often as I do, but every now and again wrestle with how everything makes sense and whether everything makes sense and where we apportion meaning in our world. And whether where we've put that meaning is worthy of there being meaning in place. And I think the scriptures are beautiful in the fact that they allow us to ask those questions. I mean, when you come to a book like Ecclesiastes, if I was writing the Bible, or at least organizing its construction, there would be a certain number of books that I'd go, probably not that helpful. And this would be one of them. If you're not familiar with Ecclesiastes, you're about to be. It starts beautifully. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Thank you very much. I'd be fine to leave it there. You see, this is the comfort that I often find in the midst of these moods. And you know, it's beautiful, isn't it? Like, we read the scriptures and we're all so faithful. Because we have this predisposition to going, life has meaning because, well, Jesus, right? Well, Solomon didn't feel the same. He was a little bit before Jesus. We're just going to read a little bit. So Solomon starts his letter with the declaration that everything is completely meaningless. As someone once told me, when approaching Ecclesiastes, they said, don't take advice from someone who's about to jump off a bridge. And I told that to someone recently, and they said, I'd probably disagree. He said, because the person in that situation has no lies left to tell. They have nothing left to lose. So why would they tell you anything except what they believed was the truth? Well, we won't digress. Solomon goes on this journey to search for life's meaning. And let's see how he did. I, the teacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. That's a bit of a big statement. I've seen it all, guys. Just letting you know, it's all meaningless. And then he goes from wisdom to pleasure. He's like, I said to myself, come now, I'll test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also provided to be meaningless. He moves on a little bit. So I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish, yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil, which I have poured up my effort and skill under the sun. I wonder if you've ever felt that. This too is, guess what? Meaningless. If you see the poor oppressed in a district, love this one, and justice and rights denied, don't be surprised. For one official is eyed by the higher one, and over them both there are higher still. The increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the field. It doesn't sound too different. I saw the tears of the oppressed. They have no comforter. Power was on the side of the oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. But better than both is the one who has never been born, who has not seen the evil that is under the sun. That's dark. But it's here. It's in the Bible. So, you know, if anyone's getting upset, it's in the Bible. It's not my fault. But we don't deal with it. But I would hazard a guess that some of you feel it. I wonder if any of you have felt it before. Just this sense of something's not right. Something doesn't make sense. And oftentimes my experience, my personal experience of growing up inside of Christianity, I had so many beautiful experiences, but the ones that were least beautiful were the ones where I felt a sense of meaningless, but I was told that I just needed to trust in Jesus without going through this process. See, I think doubt is a fundamental part of faith. And I think questioning and curiosity actually strengthens us. And we need not be threatened by it. I'm going to keep going, even though you don't want me to. And this is his conclusion. I love it. He says this all the way through. There is something else meaningless, just so you know. The righteous, and this is what we're searching for, right? The righteousness. The righteous who get what the wicked deserve, and the wicked who get what the righteous deserve. I mean, this is the end of the Beatitudes. Blessed are those who are persecuted. You know, you do all the good things, participate in God's kingdom, and everyone's going to hate you. This is what happens. This too, I say, is meaningless. No surprises. I commend the enjoyment of life because there's nothing better for a person under the sun just to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany them in their toil all the days of their life God has given them under the sun. He's saying, we may as well just eat, drink, and be merry because nothing has any meaning. Is that okay? Some people are struggling. Is this a church? So I'm going to take you on my journey, which just goes a little bit lower before scraping back up the top. I have this guy that, and this is a little bit self-indulgent, but when I'm feeling this, and I do feel this sometimes. In fact, I feel this because I try so hard oftentimes to do the right thing, to be the right person. I don't know if you've ever struggled with that. And then you encounter moments like this where you just realize that even sometimes the best and most noble attempts at justice, at righteousness, at goodness, fall tragically short of where we think the world is supposed to be. Have you ever poured your life and soul into something and then walked away looking at it just desolate? I've done that a number of times. And I often wonder, is that God trying to teach me something? Or is it simply the evidence of a world that is just incredibly broken? I mean, the world is in incredible pain and brokenness. And pain lets us know that something is broken. But the tension of Christianity is that we cannot just turn a blind eye to brokenness. We fundamentally, whilst we often find ourselves in these moments, we cannot rest in this state of meaninglessness, that there is nothing to do except eat, drink, and be merry. Because the Sermon on the Mount invites us back into participation in God's kingdom. But it does it, I think, in a different way than we commonly anticipate. No, it's gone again. Can you flick to the next slide for me? We're going to... This is my indulgence, and you may not like this. I have a guy that I read when I'm feeling really, like, low, but also, like, excited. His name's Zizek. You should You should read them, but you shouldn't at the same time. He doesn't evaluate Solomon, but he talks about exactly the same thing. He talks about the world that we live in and how we try desperately hard to make that world a better place. And as we do that, we make it so much worse. And he talks about capitalism, the society that we live in. And he says that we no longer just buy stuff to have it. We buy stuff to make us feel better about buying stuff. And he uses Starbucks as an example. Starbucks is coffee ethic. You know, so much coffee around the world is sourced and it causes pain in communities because people are taken out of school and used to pick all this sort of stuff. And he says, so what you do, instead of stopping to buy stuff, you buy more of it, but you just buy it from places that make you feel better about buying it, thinking that's going to help. If you flick to the next slide, it's the funniest quote from Zizek. He says, isn't this the reason we buy organic food? Now, we buy some organic food, so there's no judgment. He says, but who really believes that half-rotten and overpriced organic apples are really healthier than non-organic varieties? The point is that in buying them, we're not merely buying and consuming, we're simultaneously doing something meaningful and showing our capacity to care for our global awareness. The implication is you're not actually doing anything that's going to help. You're just making yourself feel better about the fact that there's so much brokenness around the place. Now, the disclaimer is that I'd rather buy ethical clothes than non-ethical clothes. I'd rather buy food without all the nonsense in it than food with all the nonsense in it. So don't hear the indictment not to do any of that. But do hear the way that Solomon, I think, is onto something in the fact that so much of life, when we are going in these circular motions, can feel meaningless, because oftentimes it is. Now, he searches for meaning in wealth, in power, in advancement, in pleasure, in intelligence, and every time he searches for meaning, he comes short. He says there's nothing valuable in these things. And I think the beautiful thing about the book of Ecclesiastes is it's so often the narrative of our own lives. Because we too try and find life's meaning in the midst of all of these searches. And I think Jesus agrees, which is a bit of a jump. But let's go to the next slide, which is the teaching from the Sermon on the Mount that we're going to just focus on for the next few minutes. So Jesus, you remember Solomon said, eat, drink, be merry, because everything is meaningless. Jesus says, therefore, don't worry about your life, what you'll eat or drink, or your body, what you'll wear. Is life not more than food, and the body not more than clothes? Which is an interesting thing, because that cycle that Solomon's caught in, trying to find meaning in the stuff that we're doing and the things that we have and the status that we've acquired, Jesus is going, why are you worrying about all of that? Why is your obsession leaning into that? Look at the birds of the air. They don't sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than them? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? If you flick to the next slide. And why do you worry about clay? So he gets even more emphatic. See how the flowers of the field grow. They do not labor or spin. The language is very similar to Solomon's language. Why do we labor and toil and spin and get round and round and round and round? If I was to be preaching this sermon tomorrow morning, on a Monday morning, some of you would be right on point. You get up and you're like, another week. We feel it. He says, yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all of his splendor. See, he comes on the side of Solomon and he agrees. Solomon, your life is meaningless. Because where you've tried to find meaning, there is no meaning. Where you've tried to find meaning in pleasure, in wisdom, in wealth, in power, in advancement, and there's nothing there because you've been looking in the wrong place. He says, yeah, I tell you, not even Solomon in all of his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that's how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today, and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not more clothe you, O you of little faith? So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all of these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom, which is that vision of a world where God's justice is at the forefront, and his righteousness, which is the characteristics that enable us to be part of that kingdom. And all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Stop the cycle of that existential crisis Every day has enough trouble of its own. See, this is an interesting shift because it highlights where so many of us get trapped into that sense of going round and round and round. Now, I don't know what that round and round looks like for you. There are many traps, I think, in life. There are many things that we can get obsessed by. The most common one that I've actually seen is people obsessed with church and Christianity. And so often we step into a world that becomes a bubble in and of itself. And the amount of times I've seen people invest years upon years upon years into churches and then come out and go, oh, well, it all collapsed. Everything fell over in the end. And it's a real struggle. This is an invitation from Jesus to invest into the only thing that has real meaning. But the challenge and the problem is it doesn't really make sense. Because at the very heart of his kingdom and his righteousness and his sense of justice is a sense of tragedy and absurdity that we need to embrace in order to make sense of anything. And so in a sense, and we'll get, I might sound like I'm babbling, but in order to make sense of the world, we have to admit that a lot of the world doesn't make sense. And if you disagree, the very centerpiece of Christianity is the cross. It's an image of life that comes through death. A Messiah beaten, bloody, and slaughtered. That our sin and brokenness was overcome by the image of a crucified first century peasant. And if you, like, it's a beautiful image, but it doesn't make that much sense. And so in order for us to find meaning in life, we often search for the things that make most sense to us. And I think I understand it, because we all do it. The challenge here in the Sermon on the Mount is that if you want to make sense of life and find true meaning, you're going to have to look in the places where you would never have expected. Paul, I think, highlights this in a way that I could never, and is much more articulate than me. He's speaking to both the Jews and the Gentiles, both of whom are trying to make sense of life. And he says, "For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate." This is Solomon. I mean, Solomon was the wisest man in the world, according to Scripture. He got given the gift of wisdom by God, and he is the one that says everything is meaningless. He had what so many of us desire: wisdom, money, respect, power, a standing, a global standing. And he was the one that said, I can't find God in any of it. Where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. See, this is where we begin to ever so slightly and ever so slowly crawl our way back out. Because in order for us to embrace a level of meaning in the world, we have to be honest and tell honest stories about the things which don't have meaning. And oftentimes the things which Solomon and even Jesus often describes as meaningless are the things that we need to exist in our life. I mean, if anyone wants to try and live without money or property or possessions, good luck. In the place where we live, good luck. I don't think it's possible. So we need that. And there's nothing fundamentally bad about that. The challenge is that you can get trapped so easily. And it becomes more difficult to step out and to find meaning in places that don't look like they should hold so much meaning. For us to drive our cars to a beautiful church and have coffee and morning tea with beautiful friends and to proclaim Christ crucified just so often strikes to the heart of nonsense inside of me. But I know that it makes so much sense. Because it's through the cross that we can begin to see the world the way it really is. It's through death that we can rise again, as the scripture invites us to do. It's through pain and suffering that somehow hope can begin to emerge. And we begin to see that life is broken, that we are broken, that you are broken. But that brokenness isn't the end. That brokenness isn't the place where we lie, because everything has a redemption. And so I often get overwhelmed with just the complexity of what it is to be a Christian, and how much that we so often need to consider in the world in which we live in. So I'm going to finish with a quote from a guy called Richard Rohr. Some of you he's been quoted a few times in the last few sermons. And then what we're going to do is I've taken a bit that he's written, and we're going to pray it. I'll pray, and then we'll reflect, and then we're going to come around the table. But the challenge, I think, to this cycle that we often find ourselves in is to find beautifully creative ways to live outside of the trap or outside of the cycle. We might still be here, but we're looking at the world in a really different way. There's one beautiful example. I read a book recently by a guy called, it was about a guy called Francis of Assisi. And some of you would have heard of Francis. He was a, I think, 13th century monk. And he was kind of beautiful. His famous quote is, "At all times preach the gospel, and if necessary use words." And he had, his way was incredibly simple. And he had this humility about him. There's this beautiful story where he was gathered together with a whole bunch of bishops and priests and monks. And they were all gathering around the teachings of this 5th century church father who was revered. And the guy who was speaking was telling them, this is what we need to do. We need to go back and listen to this guy and implement his strategies. And Francis, who's just this young kind of guy with no shoes, said, "Oh no, sorry, not me. God's called me to be a new kind of fool." And he described the rest of his ministry, which is written about in volumes today, as foolishness. Because he stepped out of that desperate quest for where we think we find meaning and just embraced the folly of life by living in a simple life. And simplicity can look different for all of us. It can be just stepping out of whatever it is that we feel holds us. I don't know what it is for you. I know what it is for me, but I don't know what it is for you. But you could probably feel it. There's probably something inside that goes, "Oof, don't talk about that." And that's okay, because this is part of stepping towards the cross. This is part of putting on those glasses where everything begins to be seen through the lens of the cross, through the lens of that foolishness. And so let's have a read as we finish. Again, next one for me, please. The deepest level of meaning is ironically the deep grace-activated acceptance of a certain meaninglessness. We're able to leave room for God to fill in the gaps and even trust that God will. This leap of logic is often called faith. The revelation of the cross, Paul says, makes you indestructible because it says that there is a way through all absurdity and tragedy, and that way is precisely through accepting absurdity and tragedy as part of God's unfathomable agenda. If you internalize the mystery of the cross, you will not fall into cynicism, failure, bitterness, or skepticism. The cross gives you a precise and profound way through the dark side of life and through all disappointments. Without it, most harden and retreat. And this is the temptation for me, having these ups and downs of whatever, and often feeling things really deeply, and having Solomon as my only friend. The temptation is to want to retreat and run away and go, none of it makes sense. We can't do any good. Run for the hills. And in fact, when I have quiet moments where I don't have much to do, I scare Nina because I'm like, we should just move to nowhere and live with no one and do nothing, resist all the evil. But the challenge is that to view the world through the lens of the cross actually forces us to lean in and not retreat, doesn't it? And the problem with leaning in is you can get cynical and bitter. Like I saw an ad pop up on Facebook. I think it was get rid of Facebook. I think I've said that before. It's just nonsense. But it was like, let's party out poverty. And it was a fashion label saying, we can end poverty by buying my clothes. I was like, you just want me to buy your stuff. Good, that's ethical. But I was just like, life is just sucks. It's run away. But I can't, nor can I be cynical, because both things are cowardly responses. Both are things that fundamentally look nothing like Jesus. What I need to do, and what we need to do, is be brave and courageous enough to step up and think of creative ways to live more like him and see the absurd image of the cross in everyone and everything that we do. And so we're going to pray, but we're going to pray in the form of me reading just a little meditation on what it would be to embrace what we're going to call simplicity, which historically by the church has been acknowledged as a spiritual discipline. What would it be to live simply as a resistance to so much of what we've talked about this morning? Is that okay? And then when I finished, I'll hand over to Kelly, and we'll go from there. So let's just meditate on these words. These aren't my words, these are adapted. When you agree to live simply, you put yourself outside of others' ability to buy you off, reward you falsely, or control you by money, status, salary, punishment, and loss or gain of anything. This is the most radical level of freedom. When you agree to live simply, you have little to protect and no desire for acquisition, even for the acquisition of any moral capital. If you eliminate such manufactured and desired superiority, religion can finally become non-violent in thought, word, and deed. When you agree to live simply, you do not consider the immigrant, the refugee, the homeless person, the foreigner as a threat to you or see them as being in competition with you. You've chosen their marginal state for yourself, freely and consciously becoming visitors and pilgrims in this world. When you voluntarily agree to live simply, you do not need to get into the frenzy of work for the sake of salary or the ability to buy non-essentials or raise your social standing. You enjoy the freedom of not climbing. You might climb for others, but not for yourself. When you agree to live simply, you have time for spiritual and corporal works of mercy. Time is not money anymore. Time is life itself. When you agree to live simply, you can easily find a natural solidarity with all people, on the edge and at the bottom, the excluded, the shamed, and the forgotten, because you stop idealizing the climb and finally realize that there isn't a top anyway. When you agree to live simply, all ideological isms lose their pull and attraction. Consumerism, classism, sexism, capitalism, ageism, lookism, communism, fascism. When you agree to live simply, people cease to be possessions and objects for your consumption. Your lusts for relationships are for others to serve you. Your need for admiration, your desire for people to use as a kind of commodity for your personal pleasure, or any need to control or manipulate slowly, very slowly, falls away. When you agree to live simply, there is no long-standing basis for addiction. You're free to enjoy, but you never let any enjoyment become your master. You practice non-addiction by letting go, not needing, and not desiring anything in particular. None of this can be done without at least the beginnings of a trust in God and a recognition that it's the tragic and absurd image of the cross that makes all else seem meaningless. To live outside of the meaningless of the world, therefore, is our act of prophetic witness.
So now let me have the people who are going to serve the communion. Do you want to come forward? People who are doing that this morning. And at West City, what we do is we always do this physical thing to take communion. You know, get up from our seats and we move to where those people have...